Hello, and welcome to the Jury Room. I'm your host, Kevin, and I will be covering anything true crime, from serial killers to cold cases, and everything in between. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Don't forget to like, subscribe, follow anywhere you can. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.
I need to thank my sponsors for today, the Downtown Growers Market. You can access local food at the Downtown Growers Market using your EBT or SNAP benefits. And the best part about that, they're going to double up your food bucks, which means you're going to get to spend half the money and get twice as much amazing local food. So go check them out. They are every Saturday from 8 to noon at Robinson Park, 8th and Central. Thank you so much to the Downtown Growers Market for sponsoring today's show.
True Consequences is a true crime and mystery podcast with stories based in New Mexico and the American Desert Southwest. I'm your host, Eric Carter Bondeen.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of True Consequences. Season 4 is here, we are rolling, and I am joined by a very special person that you either love or you hate,
depending
on who you are.
Wowzers!
I love her, but I don't know how other people feel about her.
Wow. So, I mean, I don't even know what to say.
So who are you?
Who am I? God, that's such a loaded question. I think the first layer. I am an onion. Hey, everybody. It's Lydia. It's your girl, Lydia. Thank you for having me again, Eric. I appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. This is a topic that you brought up back when we were in the Guild studio recording the last thing we did together, and took us this long to actually get our shit together. And when I say our, I mean my shit together.
No, there was collective shit gathering.
It's been a challenging year for me. A lot of things have happened, good and bad, but mostly good. But now we're here, we're recording, and we're going to talk about spree killers.
What would you, how would you define a spree killer, Eric?
I would define a spree killer as different from a serial killer because they're not killing multiple people over a long period of time with a specific type, mm-hmm. or they don't have like an MO necessarily. Sometimes they can be driven by rage or mental illness. And basically it's somebody who just goes on a rampage and kills a bunch of people without any necessarily like methodology to it. It's just kind of like senseless killings. That's how I would define it.
That makes sense to me.
Whereas a serial killer has an MO, has a type, they're probably a little bit more patient than a spree killer because they will wait for that right moment, that right person, that right target, whatever, to execute that. But spree killers, I think, are terrifying because you just never know when someone's going to snap and just start killing people.
Yeah, that's very true. And especially now in this day and age when guns are so easily accessible. I mean, they used to use the term, you know, going postal, right? Mm-hmm. And I think now that's kind of evolved into something like a spree killer terminology or, you know, concentrated mass violence and like a shooting situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we're seeing a lot of that play out, you know, at least in the last couple of decades. I think it's gotten worse where you have the school shootings and the movie theater shootings, mall shootings, all of these things that just are senseless acts of violence. Mm-hmm. I'm going to shake it up a little bit today and do a case that is pretty new, which is not something I normally do. Mm-hmm. And when I mean pretty new, it's like this year.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. So, and there's still a lot of stuff that's kind of developing with this case. So I might have to come back and revisit it once the trial and everything happens. But this is a shocking case, a disturbing case, not to say that all the other cases I cover aren't. But this one, I remember as it was evolving, it was pretty scary to know that there was somebody on the loose who was just killing people.
In Albuquerque
and in other places too. All right. So normally, I don't start with a quote because I feel like that's very cliche, but I'm going to do it today. Mm-hmm. People won't admit it. They're too busy grabbing to see the lights have fused. They can't see the darkness and the spider face beyond the great web of it all. That there's always this, if you scratch at the surface of happiness and goodness, the black and the black and the Black. And that's John Fowles, the collector. This is grim and dark. So here we go. Today, I'm discussing the case of Sean Lannon, a 47-year-old man who's been accused of killing five people between two different states and has been said to have admitted to killing 11 more.
Oh, wow.
There's belief or thought that he placed his victims in the lava tubes near Grants, New Mexico.
What?
But we'll get into that a little bit later. So some of these East Coast names I might mispronounce.
I'll help you out.
If it's not like Belen or Pohake, I can't pronounce it.
We'll do our best, okay?
We'll do our best.
I lived in New Jersey for 2 years. Granted, child. I think that I absorbed the culture correctly. So let's do this.
That's the worst Jersey accent I've ever heard, by the way.
You shut your mouth.
That's my opinion.
In my opinion, that's the worst Jersey accent I've
ever heard. Originally from Mullica Hill, an unincorporated community in Harrison Township, Gloucester County, New Jersey. I think it's Gloucester.
Mm-hmm.
Lannon will display a streak of anger, frustration, and horrifying brutality that is unrivaled. So before we jump into all of this, everyone needs to know that this case is still open. For all intents and purposes, it's technically closed because they know who the person is who was murdering everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But he hasn't been officially prosecuted or gone through the justice system yet. So it's still an open investigation, so to speak. But with that being said, just strap in for a ride that's going to leave you hanging on the edge of a cliff. Back in 2013, Lannon and his wife Jennifer were married in Pennsylvania. Jennifer was the mother of five. She had a bachelor's and master's degree from Rutgers University, Camden.
Whoa.
She also earned an RN nursing license from Helen Fuld School of Nursing in New York. And they moved to New Mexico in 2017, but divorced 2 years later.
Did you learn why they moved to New Mexico?
I did not learn why that happened. There's not a lot of information because this case is so new.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of backstory here. Records show that Sean was awarded sole custody of the couple's three children in 2019.
Whoa.
And that a protective plan from the CYFD included only supervised visitation by their mother over concerns at the time about the potential for neglect due to prescription drug abuse. You would think that this would be the end of the story, but it's not. Despite being divorced, it was reported the couple was still living together with their three children, girls 6 and 7 and a boy aged 4. And they were still attempting to work out their differences and disagreements.
So this is, and I don't want to interrupt, but so she already had 5 children prior, and then they have 3 children of their own. Or they never really clarify whose kids are whose biologically.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
There's still a lot of kids floating around. Okay.
Yeah, we don't know what's happening. So Jennifer's brother, Chris Whitman, told the Associated Press, quote, "They were still parenting together and there was no indication that there was trouble at all. From my knowledge and our family's knowledge, they were working on their relationship and heading in the right direction," end quote.
Whoa.
But the disagreements and differences all came to a head on January 17th, 2021. Lannon shot 39-year-old Jennifer, his ex-wife, in the bedroom of their home in Grants, New Mexico. This was part of a 9-page affidavit which gave reasons for his arrest. The initial shooting occurred because Sean had discovered Jennifer having a relationship with a 40-year-old man named Justin Mata. Some reports say he caught them in a compromising situation. Other reports say he just caught them in a relationship. I don't like to speculate, so we'll just say that he found out something he didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
So, self-reporting, Sean Lannon said that he found his ex-wife and Mata having sex and that they had drugged the kids to go to sleep. When Mata left the house, Jennifer was freaking out because she had thought her children had died. Sean said Jennifer took a large dose of heroin in order to overdose because she could not live without her children. And after he checked on her and checked her pulse, he realized she was still alive. He shot her in the head.
Wow.
And this is according to him in a police interview.
So something happened where he gets there and how he's able to deduce that she thought the kids had died from this alleged drugging of them to put them to sleep. I mean, I'm wondering, like, did she tell him, "I think I killed them"? Did she leave a note? I'm so curious about that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think, like I said, this is still all developing.
Mm-hmm.
And the information we have, I think, is probably pretty limited because the police are probably holding back quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, but as I get more updates, I'll definitely, you know, come back on the show and talk about it.
But there's a lot of questions here. I mean, there's questions as to if he actually caught them in a relationship, or was this just his way of excusing his behavior in his mind or rationalizing what he did?
Yeah. And it's interesting that people report that they observe their relationship moving forward and getting back on the right track. But typically, abusers show like some type of evidence to show that they're being abusive prior to that, like controlling behaviors. So it's so interesting that the family said they had no concerns. And then out of the blue, he just shoots her in the head when she is asleep, basically unconscious.
Yeah, it's weird. The whole story. And it only gets weirder
and
more confusing. So Sean then followed up this recounting by saying that he was going to kill himself. But just as he was about to do it, he heard one of the children cry out. After the murder, Sean put his wife and the bedding in a container in their backyard. 4 days after shooting his wife, he used her phone to lure Mata back to the house, and on January 21st, he killed Mata as well. Now, initially, these sound like crimes that may have been driven by something other than passion or disappointment. However, as far as speculation goes, this was either something Sean Lannon had been thinking of for a while, or he had some experience with this kind of violence in the past, and he had kept it a secret up until this moment. But more on that later. 4 days after Mata's murder, on January 25th, 21-year-old Matthew Miller, who allegedly sold drugs to the couple, was killed. So now we have Jennifer, Mata, and Matthew Miller.
Wow.
So apparently, you know, we know he killed Mata and Jennifer because he thought they were having a relationship. A report detailing what Sean Lannon confessed says that Mata somehow, before his death, showed Sean a sexually explicit photo of Miller and another man with one of Lannon's children.
No.
That's what Sean Lannon is saying. We don't know if that's true or not.
Right.
Because of this, Lannon lured Miller to the home and he shot and beat him as well. Police say that there is no evidence that remotely proves this.
A connection between Miller and the children. There's nothing to indicate that was true right now. Okay.
Right. I mean, you would think that the police would have access to Mata's phone and his records and everything else. So if he would have showed him something like that, they probably would have been able to find it. So now we have three bodies. On February 1st, Grants Police Department received a missing persons report for Miller, and as the case unfolded, Jennifer Lannon and Mata were reported missing as well. So we have three people missing from the same town.
I'm so curious who reported Mata and Jennifer missing.
Yeah, I am too. Maybe it was friends.
Yeah.
You know, Grants is a small town. So,
that's true, yeah.
If she had a job there, if Mata had a job there, people would have noticed that they didn't show up to work, so that could have been part of it too. So 8 days later, on February 9th, Miller's vehicle was found parked a few blocks from the Lannon home. During investigation, a resident near the area of discovery said the car had been there since January 26th. So things are going to go more off the rails than they already have as I continue with the story. When the police reached out to Jennifer's parents, her mother said she had not seen or heard from Jennifer since January 9th and said it is odd as she normally keeps in contact at least every few weeks. In addition, the mom says she got a call from Sean who said Jennifer hit him with a frying pan and that she was having an affair with Mata. To double down on his story, he told police some information after they questioned him for help in regards to the missing persons case involving his wife. He told police that he saw her on February 10th and told them Jennifer Lannon, Mata, and an unidentified man had driven away in a white vehicle heading to Arizona to score.
He's trying to throw them off the tracks.
It's a red herring, right? There was no evidence of a white vehicle, but there was evidence of Sean Lannon driving Miller's car to a long-term parking spot. He continued to weave a tale for police when he said that Jennifer had a history of affairs and drug addiction and had gone missing before. I suppose it's just easier to double down, but while the drug testimony might have been slightly correct, assuming the testimony he gave regarding the overdose, there's nothing to support the idea that she had a history of affairs. He said that, quote, he thinks Jennifer is alive and will show up when she needs money, end quote.
And he knows, like, obviously he knows what he's done this entire time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Such a scumbag.
Totally.
I mean, I just don't understand people that, well, I'll never understand murderers, number one, but to, like, just act like everything's fine. Like, no, they went to go buy drugs. It's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah. And it goes back to, like, essentially blaming the victim, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no, she's this bad mom. She's disappeared. She's going to go try to score some smack. She's having affairs. She's slutting around. So all of those classic tropes about, like, shaming the victim, shaming a woman. Yeah.
Yeah. Jennifer's brother contradicts this when he says, quote, she was a great mom. And just, it would be uncharacteristic of her to not be with her children, end quote. So just to cover his future tracks, he told police he was planning to travel with his children to South Jersey so they could stay with Jennifer's mother while he worked to get a new job and an apartment in the city of Albuquerque. A day after he was questioned about his wife's whereabouts, someone called and told investigators Sean had killed the three missing persons. The man also volunteered the information that at some point, Lannon had been asking people for an electric saw.
Oh my God. He's putting out feelers. Like, does anybody have anything that I could chop stuff with?
Right.
I will not specify or clarify what kind of stuff I need to chop.
I think this is probably one example of the difference between a serial killer and a spree killer. Is that serial killers are so methodical and careful, you know, until they're not. But for a long time, a lot of them are very careful. And
they have the materials they already need.
Right. And they're not going to go ask random people for electric saws to dispose of bodies. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's going to cause problems for them in the future.
Right.
So other witnesses said that Lannon seemed to have been involved in a large scale effort to clean something up. One woman told police he had appeared at her home all bleached out with blisters and cuts on his hand.
So like he was drenched in bleach.
That's what I assume. I mean, yeah. That's like New Mexico, all bleached out.
Oh, he was all bleached out.
You should have seen it.
You should have seen it. Everything was got bleach all over it. Like his shirt had white spots on it.
I'm sure he probably smelled like bleach too.
Yeah.
Right? During all of this time, Lannon never reached out to police for any update on the search for his ex-wife. It was always the other way around.
Police contacting him. Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything?
Mm-hmm.
Never him, you know, being proactive and saying, have you found her?
Right. Which that says a lot.
So at this time, were the kids back with her mom in Jersey?
I think we're getting there.
Okay.
They're not there yet.
Oh, got it. Okay.
So Lannon has three bodies. What's he going to do to cover his tracks? Hmm. There was a local man who was reported to live in his truck and do odd jobs for money. So Lannon hired him to move the bodies.
Did the guy know they were bodies?
No.
Okay.
He needed a place to hide them before he left for New Jersey with his children on February 24th. He agreed to pay the man, quote, if he could move some boxes for him and put them in storage, end quote. The complaint in reference to this states, quote, Sean Lannon reportedly contacted, I can't pronounce this guy's name, the man through an acquaintance of him on February 24th and agreed to pay him cash to move some boxes for him and put them in storage.
Why do people put bodies in storage units? I don't understand that.
I think it's because people probably don't necessarily go to storage units a lot.
But it's just like, it still seems like such an obvious place. Like the body's going to decompose.
Well, if you remember the prison break episode, mm-hmm. there were like the prisoners hanging out in the storage room, in the storage area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it just seems like a seedy place
to
do things. All I've ever used storage units for is furniture. So
you mean to store things?
Right.
Right.
But not bodies.
Not bodies.
Not bodies, yeah. The complaint states that Lannon loaded the storage bins that contained the dismembered bodies in the back of his truck, and the two men reportedly unsuccessfully looked for a storage area. The police complaint says in a police interview with Lannon, he reportedly said that after returning to an apartment complex, the man told Lannon to remove the bins from his truck. Lannon struck him several times in the face, knocking him unconscious before striking him in the head and face with a hammer.
Jesus!
It would soon be discovered that he used a small sledgehammer that he found in the truck. He then cleaned up the interior of the truck and put the man's body in the passenger seat, covered up with a black tarp. Then Lannon parked the car outside of an apartment complex where he was staying with his children and a friend. He left the truck next to a trash bin in an effort to mask the smell of the decomposing bodies.
Oh, man.
So now there's four bodies in this truck. In addition, on February 24th, around a month after the murders and on the same day as that man's murder, Lannon was arrested on a warrant after he was charged with assault and battery from an October 2020 incident. While arrested for this, he was questioned about the missing persons case. Lannon denied any crimes but acknowledged hiding a bag with a gun and his ex-wife's IDs in the ceiling of their home in Grants. When Lannon was released on March 2nd, he drove back to the apartment complex and found the truck where he had left it, still containing the bodies of the people that he had killed. The next day, he moved the truck and the bodies to the Albuquerque International Sunport.
Oh my God, mm-hmm. I know this story. Mm-hmm. Yes,
mm-hmm.
That's right.
On March 4th, he flew with three children to New Jersey. He told Jennifer's family he was going back to New Mexico to, quote, look for Jennifer.
Oh, man. Sure. That was the only positive thing that he has done right now leading up to this is that he's taking the kids away from New Mexico and getting them away from him.
Yeah. Yeah. That's his only redeeming thing that he's done this entire time.
Is put them in safety. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he had stayed with them and continued this, like, frantic spiral that they would have been harmed more than they already have been.
Yeah. So the three murders were still considered missing persons cases until the next day, when the bodies were found at 3:25 in the morning. And at this point, it became a quadruple murder.
Wow.
While in New Jersey on March 8th, a welfare check turned up the body of 66-year-old Michael Dabrowski. At some point between March 4th and March 8th, Lannon broke into Dabkowski's home and beat him to death with a hammer.
What?
Mm-hmm. Lannon told investigators that Dabkowski had sexually abused him as a child.
Oh, my God.
And that he had gone to the home to retrieve sexually explicit photos. These photos were said by Lannon to contain proof of the abuse. Police say there's no evidence of this. Dabkowski did mentor Sean and his brother through a Big Brother program in the 1980s. In addition, apparently, Dabkowski was at a birthday party for one of the Lannon children a couple of years ago, and everything seemed okay.
That piece is so hard for me. Like, I want to believe him when he says that he was abused as a child.
Yeah.
I know that he's this horrible monster, but it's a statistical anomaly for somebody to make up abuse, to lie about abuse.
Yeah.
It happens so rarely.
Well, and even if that's true, it doesn't excuse any of his behavior.
Of course, right. But I think that it deserves to be acknowledged that as a child he was damaged.
Sure. I'm prone to believe victims as well. I think that there is something going on in his head where he's constantly trying to rationalize this behavior that he's doing. Whether or not he was abused, and I'm not going to debate it because I don't know and I can't prove it. That doesn't change the fact that he killed people who, should not have been killed.
Right.
And it doesn't change the fact that he could have gone about this differently.
Mm-hmm.
So he probably needed help. I mean, he obviously needed help.
Right.
And wasn't getting it. So it's a terrible situation. And even if Dabkowski did do this, maybe he did need to be punished for abusing people. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the police are saying there's no evidence of that. And I'm sure they went through Dabkowski's home to find out if that was actually true, if there were actually photos there. I don't know. So now we're
up to five bodies.
Five bodies, yep. So now he begins a cross-country trip in a car back to Albuquerque. On March 10th, 2 days after the murder of Michael Dabkowski, a search for Lannon proved fruitful. He was found and arrested in St. Louis, Missouri. And while there, he was questioned by multiple police departments who traveled there. He was then sent back to New Jersey. So far, during the investigation, it's been discovered that the containers in the pickup truck were discovered to match the same style of containers found in the storage unit that Lannon used. They also found rolls of duct tape in the storage unit that seemed to be consistent with the duct tape that was found on the clothes of Jennifer Lannon. In terms of charges, three criminal complaints were filed against Lannon on March 26th in Magistrate Court, Cibola County. He was charged with the murder of Jennifer Lannon as well as the kidnapping of Mata and Miller. He also faces many counts of tampering with evidence in connection with each homicide. Quote, the tampering charges were brought due to the severing of the male victim's bodies, efforts to clean the crime scene, and the removal of all three victims' remains from Grants, end quote. He is, of course, also charged in New Jersey as well. During a hearing in New Jersey, Lannon's public defender, Frank Unger, challenged probable cause for the murder charge involving Dabkowski. He said that Dabkowski allowed Lannon into his home and that what followed was, at worst, manslaughter provoked by passion, not homicide. Unger said that Lannon didn't want anyone to have control over him any longer, and that's why he was trying to take back the photos. Dabkowski had, quote, documented those sexual assaults, those rapes, by taking pictures of himself with Mr. Lannon in sexually compromised positions, end quote. It was also said that Lannon retrieved two hammers from Dabkowski's garage and gave them to the victim. When he did, he said, you're going to need these. I don't want to hurt you. The public defender wanted the judge to release Lannon pretrial. He said he had no prior convictions and was an Army veteran with an honorable discharge. So despite this argument, the judge ordered Lannon to remain in jail, which is the right decision, in my opinion. Perhaps it was the lack of emotion that Lannon felt that caused the judge to make the decision to keep him in. Perhaps it was the flight risk, which is an important thing to keep in mind considering his travel between murders. Perhaps it truly was the fact that he was planning on killing a sixth person when he was caught. In this case, he was planning on killing the other person in the photos, he says, that were shown to him by Mata, which involved one of his children with the two men. Maybe it had to do with the fact that he had claimed to have killed an additional 11 people. Apparently, all drug dealers in the Grants, New Mexico area, placing them in different places, at an oil refinery in Jamestown where he worked, inside lava tubes near Grants. But this confession has not been substantiated, despite police investigating these locations.
Wow.
So whether it was one of these things or all of these things, Sean Lannon remains behind bars in Salem County Correctional Facility in Woodstown, New Jersey, awaiting trial.
Wow.
Terrible, terrible, terrible story. And it's going to be interesting to see how this all unfolds.
With absolutely.
The charges in multiple states and different jurisdictions.
And it's just all so heinous and violent.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. And that's it. So we're going to take a break. And we're back.
Well, let's keep the sadness going.
Okay.
We're going to talk about another spree killer. And this is actually an older case. This has happened, I think it's we're almost now at 16 years ago that this happened. This happened here in Albuquerque in August of 2005. And a lot of the research that I did really breaks down it based on timeline. So that's kind of how I'm going to present it to everybody, is a timeline of events. Because when we think about threat assessment, I'm using that term very broadly. I've had a number of threat assessment trainings in the type of work that I do professionally. And so that's how I looked at this case, this spree killer case, is, you know, looking at emergent threat and what they call the pathway to violence. So basically somebody escalating their behavior as they migrate towards the actual act of violence. So all of these other pieces come before, and the goal was to recognize those pieces before the violence is enacted, obviously. But the trick is, how do you connect the dots with right. the hopes of being able to prevent the violence? And this is a really frustrating case, because it was only after a lot of investigative reporting, a lot of investigation, a lot of officials working on this case, that they were able to create these timelines and identify all of the misconnections. And it's very easy. I'm going to preface this with, it's so easy to be, you know, Monday, what do they call it? Monday morning quarterbacking. What do you call
armchair
it?
Armchair
detective. Yeah, armchair detective. And, you know, analyzing these things in a retrospect. But that's the job of detectives, is to identify what went wrong and what could be done correctly in the future. So this is about John Hyde. And this happened in Albuquerque in August of 2005.
I remember this case.
I remember it. I remember being in college at the time. I had friends in the university area who, you know, I'll talk about later on, who actually, you know, a lot of the night when the crescendo really hit, they remember hearing these gunshots, mm-hmm. hearing people calling for help. So let's talk a little bit about John Hyde.
Okay.
So this is an important case because it highlights mental health, the hurdles to accessing mental health care, and the ease of accessing weapons, I believe, in our culture. So John Hyde was adopted. His brother was adopted. They were raised mostly in Albuquerque growing up. John was known to be very bright. He had actually graduated high school and had been given a number of scholarships, but it's not clear that he ever utilized them to go to college or anything like that. But he had been treated for schizophrenia for a long time, and schizophrenia is a really serious mental health disorder. There could be kind of small, truncated experiences of psychosis, or it could be a lifelong thing. For John, it sounds like it was a lifelong battle, and that still continues today. So he had no violent criminal history. Of course, he had had interactions with police, but nothing to indicate that he was capable of violence. And so that's another thing to keep in mind whenever you're looking at like threat assessment. You look to see if somebody's had a previous history of acting violent towards others or animals or small children. Let's start with the day, a few days leading up to this. So the actual shooting was done, the actual spree killing was August 18th, 2005. But prior to that, there were things leading up to it. So we know, based on the timeline of investigative reporters that they put together, so leading up to the days of the spree killing, family noticed a decline. They noticed that John was struggling. His family saw that there was a decline in his appearance. He was no longer taking care of himself. He wasn't grooming himself. He wasn't bathing. But he was still reaching out for help. His medication had recently been changed, and he was starting to experience a lot of really negative side effects from the medication. Additionally to this change in the medication, we later learned that he had been dismissed from an AA group. So this is kind of red flag number one, that you're terminated from something, or you're forced to separate from something that has otherwise been like a support system for you, mm-hmm. right? So he is basically cut off from his AA group because he had allegedly been trying to solicit marijuana from members. So on August 15th, he had a confrontation with a key shop worker due to like a dispute about the cost, and he basically tells the key shop worker that he's going to settle this with a bullet between his eyes.
Whoa.
Later that day, on August 15th, he goes to where he's being treated. He goes to the actual hospital where he's being treated, Presbyterian Casement Hospital, to see his doc, and he's told to leave. He's told by administrative and people and security to leave. And again, it was another potential missed opportunity to you know, again, this is all, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking and psychologist armchair stuff, but he had gone there to complain about the side effects of his medications. He becomes irate and he's told to leave. While he's there, he's demanding that he be able to see somebody. It doesn't happen. And he's basically kicked out. So that's like such a frustrating piece that I think is so hard, especially for, I would only imagine it's so hard for the families affected or John's family, is that we'll see later on this continued pattern of him going to the hospital and demanding to talk to somebody about his medication and how he is declining, and he has refused every single time.
Being declined by the hospital?
Yep.
Really?
Exactly. So we know that after he leaves the hospital, he's kicked out by security and basically told, make an appointment and we'll let you know. After he leaves the hospital, he goes to Sportsman Warehouse to buy ammunition. Sportsman Warehouse tells him they don't have that ammunition in stock. He has to wait so they can order it, and this further enrages him. He basically becomes more hostile and eventually he leaves. On August 16th, the next day, he goes back to Presbyterian. He's even more agitated. He's demanding to be seen, and he's refused service again. He's refused an appointment, an immediate appointment. And he even tells them, you guys don't have the right to, quote, refuse me care, because that's what he feels is going on. So we're looking back again at the idea of threat assessment. This is another opportunity where theoretically you would think somebody could pull up his chart and see that he's being treated for these things, or realizing how agitated he is and aggressive he's becoming. This is now the second time that he's come in person to the hospital where he is treated at and is demanding to be seen, and he is told no. He becomes agitated and irate and he leaves.
Do you have any idea why they kept telling him no? Why weren't they willing to help him?
That's a really good question. Nobody has ever – none of the reading or the research I've been able to find has been able to pinpoint why nobody would just say, okay, let's sit you down with somebody and at least assess you right now to see, right? Everything else just seems to indicate that he's coming, he's asking for help. And for whatever reason, they're following their procedure of, no, you need to make an appointment and we'll get back to you later. So they don't really seem to recognize that this is this kind of hitting crisis point level.
Yeah.
Exactly. So another thing that I learned, and again, I've done kind of like various threat assessment trainings, and this has come up before, this specific case, is when they're looking at like the pathway to violence, is that during this interaction at the 16th, he apparently there's some sort of interaction where he either asks to use the restroom or somebody directs him to the restrooms, and he's seen leaving the women's bathroom. And it's allegedly reported that a female administrator or somebody who works in the hospital was like, hey, that's the women's bathroom. What are you doing there? And apparently kind of laughs it off. And he perceives this as some sort of insult. Like, you're so stupid. You went into the women's bathroom. Like, that's so embarrassing for you.
Oh my God.
And again, this is just like kind of third hand information.
Sure.
But they think like this potentially added to the grievance, if this in fact happened, that he saw this as another like, haha, you look so stupid coming out of the women's bathroom. And this was all a joke on you. And so he becomes like enraged with this idea that somebody was kind of like setting him up or taking a laugh at his expense. It's later realized that when he was in the women's bathroom, he urinated over everything, urinated all over the walls.
My God.
So he's like basically told to leave again under the direction of security. And another point of threat assessment is to look at what is like the alleged grievance or the perceived grievance. What do they think? Do they feel like they're being wronged, or how they feel like they're being wronged? Mm-hmm. So I feel like this potentially fed into his perceived grievance that he had against this healthcare system, where not only are you denying me care that I feel, but you're also mocking me and you're making fun of me.
Do you know if his family was aware of all of this that was happening?
Yeah, so we'll go into that. So John was adopted, and his brother Robert was also adopted.
Right.
And Robert reported that they always knew John suffered with mental health issues, but that John was always pretty much proactive in trying to get help. Although they saw this decline and they were worried about him.
Mm-hmm.
John, as you can see with all his various efforts to be seen at Presbyterian, he was not avoiding mental health care.
Right, but he was being ignored or...
Yeah, whether it was intentional or not.
Or not, yeah, that's what happened.
Yep.
And yeah, that's the thing that really frustrates me, I think, just as a person who has had to navigate the medical system here in one way or another. The mentality of that's our policy,
right,
is so pervasive.
Yeah, make an appointment.
And every in every medical system here in New Mexico and probably in America is very much like, this is how it is. And whether you like it or not, like, that's how it is. And this, you know, I'm just doing my job or whatever. But I just feel like there needs to be more safeguards in place for situations like this.
Yeah. I mean, it's really surprising that, from what I could read, nobody really assessed him when he kept coming back and coming back to the hospital saying, I need to see somebody. Nobody ever – it doesn't look like anybody ever sat down with him and said, you know, let's walk through what your concerns are and let's see if you're in an elevated risk that would require like a triage appointment, right?
So, or let's get you to the emergency room.
Exactly, yeah. Right? So he goes the 15th, the 16th. He comes back again to Presbyterian looking for help on the 17th. He goes back. He says he meets with them. He says, I need somebody to see me. My medication is affecting me. And somebody tells him, we're going to look into your concerns, basically. We're going to look into your requests. So again, he's not seen by any medical professional, but he's told by an administrator that they'll look into it. He left the hospital and he rides a motorcycle. That's his form of transportation. And he goes to a motorcycle shop where he typically goes to, and he becomes confrontational with the employees there. And so he leaves that motorcycle shop. He goes to another motorcycle shop that he's gone to before, and he has another confrontation there. He starts spewing a bunch of racist stuff. He shares more paranoid, delusional thoughts with the people who work there, talking about how APD has been siphoning gas from vehicles, and then he eventually leaves. That evening, a Department of Transportation employee named Ben Lopez talked to his wife, kind of unpacking the day that he had, and he mentioned kind of in passing that when he was leaving work that evening of August the 17th, he interacted with a man on a motorcycle who had approached him asking for oil for his motorcycle. And Mr. Lopez was like, no, I'm not going to give that to you. And the man took off. And this was just kind of in passing that Ben is, you know, briefing his wife about his day. So we're still on August 17th, and we don't know for sure if that the person who Ben Lopez interacted with is John Hyde. There's no way to confirm that because John Hyde has never confirmed that conversation. Mm-hmm. But it's entirely possible, given what we know about John Hyde, that he was an avid motorcyclist and was basically cruising around the city that day.
Right.
So on August 17th, Hyde moves on to a tattoo shop and he starts making bizarre comments to the tattoo shop employees that cops are chasing him. And eventually another argument ensues between him and the tattoo shop employees, and he's asked to leave, and he allegedly threatens the employees, saying, you don't know who you're messing with. On the night of the 17th, his manic behavior continues to more locations all over the city. Around 11 o'clock, he interacts with a coffee shop employee, and he mentions being followed by police and asking the coffee shop employee if there's police in the area. He eventually leaves this coffee shop, finds himself at a Denny's around 2 a.m. and talks to the employee about being denied care at Presbyterian. And he tells the employee at Denny's that he's going to get revenge. He's going to be seeking retribution against those who have wronged him. So we finally come to August 18, 2005, and it's called the saddest day in Albuquerque history. That's what police called it. That's what the newspapers referred to it as. Ben Lopez's body was found around 6:30 a.m. He had been shot in the chest, but the initial suspect is thought to be a colleague of Ben's. So again, Ben is the Department of Transportation employee who worked around the Los Volcanes area, and when his body's discovered and police start looking into it, they think that it was a colleague that Lopez had a conflict with. And we're going to get to a really bizarre parallel that just kind of like, you know, the emoji, blow your mind emoji. That's the reaction I had when I found this, when I heard about this parallel. So at 7 a.m., John Hyde's brother, Robert, calls police because John's tires had been slashed and his girlfriend's tires had been slashed. And the girlfriend tells police that she thinks John Hyde is the one that did it. So around 9 o'clock, John goes back to Presbyterian, and he gets into another argument with staff there, and witnesses overhear him cursing at staff and threatening them with violence and death. So eventually he leaves Presbyterian, and police are actively working the homicide of Ben. And around 11 a.m., John is making calls to a community health provider, and he's telling them that he cannot be seen by Presbyterian, that he's being denied care, and that he needs to see somebody immediately. So they make it up. This community healthcare provider makes an appointment for him at 3 p.m. And they actually offer to see him sooner, but he's like, no, I need time to take a shower and get cleaned up, but I'll be there at 3 p.m. And he never makes that appointment. So the first time that we see somebody doing an initial safety assessment with him was also when he called this healthcare provider. They did the, you know, are you a threat to yourself or others? And he said no. Mm. So around 1 p.m., John calls the healthcare provider back and he leaves a voicemail. So nobody answers this 1 p.m. call. It goes to voicemail and he leaves a message basically saying, I'm going to kill you all and I'm going to kill everybody at Presbyterian. That voice message wasn't heard until 3 p.m. when a provider who's familiar with John was checking the messages and hears this. The provider immediately calls police and lets them know that he's left this voice message. And at the time, police were still, they didn't believe John was a suspect for this Ben Lopez homicide. Again, they were still investigating the possibility that it was a colleague that Ben Lopez had had conflict with. So that's the route that they're taking, is that they're looking into this colleague allegedly potentially killing Ben Lopez.
Well, and that's probably because there's not anything to link him to John Hyde anyway, right?
Right.
Like, there's no direct link to him.
Right. And it goes back to that lack of the appropriate threat assessment. So connecting those dots, right? So Presbyterian has had multiple interactions with him and he leaves a voice message on a provider basically saying, I'm going to do this. So by 4 p.m., Hyde goes to High Velocity Motorcycles on Zuni and he asks to trade 2 quarts of oil as an IOU. But employees see him throwing some things in a dumpster before he goes into the store. And by 4:20, an executive at Presbyterian Hospital calls police because he's been made aware of these threats that the voice message that John had made previously. He was contacted by the mental health provider, the community mental health provider, and said, hey, John Hyde left these messages. He says he's coming for you and he's coming for us. So the Presbyterian executive goes into action and they start discerning that they consider this a serious emergency and consider him to be a genuine threat. By 4:30 p.m., the mental health agency, community mental health agency where John had his 3 p.m. appointment, they were still waiting for him to show up. Obviously, he never shows. Mm. At this time, detectives are still interviewing people about Mr. Lopez's death. By 4:30, they were still interviewing people directly related to Ben Lopez to see if they could get more information. At 4:53, 911 gets a call from a teenager. He's 17 years old. His name is David Fisher, and he's already been shot through his hand.
Oh.
And he had his hand pressed to his chest when he was shot. The bullet went through his hand and into his chest, but he's still able to call 911 and ask for help. And so here's a little bit of what that call looked like. Where are you? I'm at River Valley Motorcycles. Did you know who killed you? Who did this to you? And he says, yes. But the operator doesn't ask, who is it? The operator goes to, like, other questions.
Hmm.
And Fisher starts saying, hurry up, hurry up. He took all the money from the cash register. And the dispatcher says, so you were robbed. Yes, he robbed us. He shot me. He took all of the money. He shot me and he shot my friend.
Hmm.
And so they continue to have this dialogue. And Fisher gets really quiet. And he says, please hurry up. He's coming back.
Hmm.
And at that time, John Hyde comes back into the motorcycle shop and shoots the 17-year-old in the head.
Oh, no.
I know. It's so sad. But the operator never got the name. The phone call ends. Fisher is dead. Garrett Iverson, who also worked at the motorcycle shop, is dead. And police are now looking at this new homicide, still not realizing there's a link between the Department of Transportation employee's death and these young men who worked at this motorcycle shop. And by 5:49, the head of Presbyterian Hospital phones the brother of John Hyde. He calls his brother Robert and says that John has been making threats and that they're asking police to look for him and to secure him for a medical evaluation.
Oh my God, that's like too late.
Right. And so, but nobody knows, right? Nobody has made these connections. Robert thinks, oh, what a relief. I'm so glad that you guys are doing this. And he thinks this is perfect timing. I'm glad you're going to find him before he could do anything, not knowing that his brother had already done these things. So when Robert was later interviewed, they asked, you know, how concerned were you when you got this call? And he said, you know, I was so concerned about my brother. But once I got the call from the hospital saying we're looking for him and we're going to commit him involuntarily, basically, he said, I felt such a relief. He said, I felt so relieved that they were going to get him before he could do anything to hurt somebody. So, you know, after he has this conversation with the hospital administrator, he gets a call again from hospital security. They're asking him for a description of what John Hyde typically looks like. You know, he tells them he's usually wearing a long-sleeved leather motorcycle jacket, camouflage pants, long hair, a black helmet, and he's got like a spray-painted black dirt bike motorcycle type of thing. And so the hospital starts working on giving him, like, drafting up this description so that they could eventually pass it on to police so that they could potentially pick up John, again, not knowing that John's already committed these murders. And the hospital's written request to police says, John Hyde presents a likelihood of serious harm to others or to self. Immediate detention is necessary. And John's brother also confirms to the hospital that he has guns. He's a hunter. He knows how to use guns. And that gun piece is something that we'll look at a little bit later. Just another kind of unusual piece of this puzzle that came up specifically around weapons. So the Presbyterian Hospital administrator, for some reason, isn't getting the response that he expected from police when he's trying to convey this potential threat. So he reaches out to a friend of his who happens to be a U.S. Marshal. And so at 6:15 p.m., he reaches out to a friend and says, hey, I need to get APD's attention. This guy is really dangerous, but I don't feel like they're responding, you know, as quickly as they need to.
Yeah.
And so this U.S. Marshal friend, not in his professional capacity as a U.S. Marshal, but as a friend, decides to help try to put some of those pieces together. Around 6:15 p.m., detectives were interviewing anybody who was familiar with the interaction at the motorcycle store. And an unnamed witness says that three black men walked into a nearby apartment complex, and one of them said something along the lines of, I'll put a cap in your ass. And so this is another piece that potentially derails, right, the investigation, or, you know, how they're going to connect these dots. Is this racist, right?
Can I just – okay, first of all, this has been one of the most frustrating things doing the show, is learning about all the people who send police on false – wild goose chases, red herrings, whatever. It's just so frustrating. Like, if you don't have any actual evidence about something, like, keep your mouth shut.
Yeah.
Because you're not helping. You're making it way worse.
Right. And there's no indication that that's what's so frustrating about this piece when I read it, is like, nobody knows who this person was, what their motivation was,
right,
or if they even actually witnessed
anything.
Apparently three black men threatening the motorcycle people, the motorcycle store people, and then going off into an apartment complex and saying, I'll put a cap in your ass. Again, so now we have two separate investigations that nobody realizes are connected. So we have the Department of Transportation's employee, Ben Lopez's murder, which is being treated as a potential colleague murder. Mm-hmm. And then this homicide of the 17-year-old young man who, sadly enough, like, he had dreams to go pro in dirt bike racing. He had a competition coming up that weekend. Mm. Yeah, it's really sad. So at 6:29 p.m., Presbyterian officials sent out a mass email basically saying, like, we believe that this is a credible threat. We believe the hospital's in danger. Here's the description of what to be on the look for. And they give Hyde's description. And they describe what the motorcycle he uses as. At 6:30, APD SWAT is in charge of the crisis intervention team. And they're being asked for help dealing with a man matching Hyde's description, who has been threatening to kill the Presbyterian Hospital employees. APD briefs the crisis intervention team, and they tell them that Hyde has the motive and the ability to enact serious harm. So they're in this process to do a mental health pickup. So basically what happens is that a mental health provider with admitting privileges can do a written request to authorities saying, I believe this patient of mine or this person under my care poses an imminent threat to self or others. And they basically create a summary of what they look like, what the concerns are, and what the safety risks are. Mm-hmm. And they give it to authorities with the hopes that they can go and pick them up and bring them to, for Albuquerque, UNM Mental Health. So APD has this request now to go and pick up Hyde, and that they believe him to be a credible threat. At the time, at the same time, around 6:30, a police officer calls Robert Hyde, John's brother, and tells him that they're going to go pick him up. And they assure Robert that they're going to use well-trained teams to go get him. And Robert tells them that John grew up around guns, he knows how to use them, and he has them. And I'm bringing this up because in other videos that I saw, the APD chief of police at the time was Ray Schultz. And whenever he was giving press conferences about this incident, he was talking about how frustrated he was that he felt that his team wasn't properly briefed about the risk or the threat that John Hyde posed. But all the research that I've done indicates that they were told on several occasions that he posed a credible threat, that he did have what they call as access to means, basically mm-hmm. access to a gun. Mm-hmm. So they've already checked off these boxes, right? He said, I'm going to do these things. We know that he's capable of doing them, and we know that he has the means to do them.
So it sounds like damage control on the part of the communications office of the police in that at that point.
Maybe,
Because or it's either that or it's lack of communication from people right. who are receiving this information.
I think entirely both of those things could are be true possible. At the same time, yeah. Or yeah, exactly. True at the same time that maybe they underestimated the threat. Maybe they thought, hey, and we'll get into this a little bit later, but the officers that they send to go and basically detain Hyde were very seasoned. They had come out of retirement, gone back into working. And we'll also look at what that interaction with those officers looked like. So I think that this is probably one of the most frustrating, to me, this feels like one of the most frustrating cases that we've ever talked about on this show, mm-hmm. because you already have these several days, 3 days of somebody coming looking for help and being denied. And then you have the, when they finally connect all the pieces, it's technically already too,
it's
late,
too late
because,
yeah,
Ben Lopez is dead. The young men at the motorcycle shop are dead. Mm-hmm. And by the time police go to look for John, it's almost too late. But right. they don't realize what he's already done.
Right.
So other reports are circling in about sightings of John Hyde, that a lot of people are seeing him around. And he's basically – he lives in the university area. And if anybody's familiar with the UNM area, there's all these little side residential streets basically surrounding the campus. And there's tons of homes and there's tons of little shops here and there. There's – like random smoke shops, hair salons, you name it.
Pita shop.
Yeah. So, and the homes are really close together too. And they call it the student ghetto. So like the rent is usually really cheap. They're really studio apartments.
Right. And a lot of the landlords are considered slumlords in that neighborhood just because they don't really take care of the properties. You're just kind of like, well, the rent's cheap, so.
Exactly. So and close to campus. Right. Yeah. And so this is where John lives too. So it makes sense that he's seen circulating around this entire university area.
I think it's important to note too that it's a very pedestrian area. It's not like, I mean, there's a lot of cars, but a lot of people are just walking to campus. They're walking to lunch. They're, you know, there's a lot of people just moving around in that neighborhood.
Already we have Mr. Lopez, his body is found at 6:30 a.m. on the 18th. We're already now looking at 7:30 and 8:30 p.m. on the 18th. So 12 hours have elapsed. A crisis intervention detective makes a call to Casement Presbyterian, and they're told that the hospital has already sent paperwork for a pickup order to APD and the state police. The detective then calls dispatch, and they say they haven't received the paperwork. Mm-hmm. So again, it's like so frustrating, right, to see this in hindsight and see all these misconnections. So the crisis intervention team is trying to get the paperwork so that they can potentially help facilitate the pickup. APD is saying we don't have it. Presbyterian is saying we already sent it. So finally, a certificate of evaluation is faxed to the Southeast substation, so closest to where John Hyde lives. Mm-hmm. And police are able to get a search warrant because they're still looking at the murders at the motorcycle shop. So they get a search warrant because they want to see they want to basically look at the entire facility. And I was like thinking about how weird that is. Like, why would they need a search warrant to inspect the motorcycle shop? Couldn't the owner just give them permission?
Yeah, he could, but maybe he didn't.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think about that. It was just another thing that stood out. Like, wow, it seems so weird that all this time and energy was focused on the search mm-hmm. warrant when potentially they could have just picked up a phone and said, hey, your employees were killed here. Let us search the place. So police dispatchers get a call around 8:47, and police are finally asked to go pick up Hyde at his residence. And he lives on Gold, like the Gold Ash area. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah.
So the officers that get the call are officers Michael King, who was 50 at the time, and Officer Richard Smith, who was 46 at the time. Mm. They were seasoned officers. They had been on the force. They retired. They came back. I hear that a lot from cops. They just can't stay retired. They just go antsy in their pantsies, and they just like either want to get involved again, either on the beat or other things. Mm-hmm. Like I met a cop the other day who now does like a review about use of force and stuff.
Some of them do private investigations.
Yeah.
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 I just have to say, I don't like how you're talking about these police officers in the past tense. It's giving me foreshadowing vibes. I'm not happy about it, but go ahead.
So dispatch gets the call. Officers Michael King, who's 50, Richard Smith, who's 46 at the time. They take the orders to go and pick him up. They reviewed his certificate of evaluation, and they are advised that Hyde has made threats against hospital personnel and that he has access to weapons. So they're told, they have the information, they go to his house. So by this time, July, August, the sun sets really late here mm-hmm. in Albuquerque. At this time, the sun is finally starting to set. Police go to his apartment. They knock on the door. He answers it. It's around 9:43. They start recording on their belt. This was pre-camera era, but they have those little voice recorders. Hyde lives in a small apartment. The two officers kind of stand on a tiny porch and they're, you know, talking to Hyde while he's inside the apartment, and they're persuading him to come with him. Now, I've never listened to the audio that they recorded. I don't even know if it's been released to the public, and I'll kind of go into why later on. But everything that is reported about those who have heard the recording say that Hyde was lucid during the conversation, and it was an amicable conversation. They're basically saying, hey, we got this request. We're asking you to come with us. Hyde says, can I get a drink of water? They say, sure. He goes, gets a drink of water. They let him pack a small bag so that he can have some belongings with him when he goes to the hospital. And they start the process of like removing him from the apartment. And at the time, he's going with them, and there's no reason to be concerned. So around 10 o'clock, that's when the recording ends. And 10:15, Smith calls into dispatch and says, officer down. He's saying, shots fired, officer down. King was shot one time, and he fell immediately. Smith gets into a gun battle with Hyde. Smith leaves his space where he's safe because he's trying to retrieve King's body. And Ray Schultz, the chief of police at the time, said that's probably what got Smith killed, was his effort to save his buddy, his colleague. He leaves his safe place and tries to get King. And in the process of trying to get King's body, he's shot fatally. It went through the armpit of his bulletproof vest, and he was also shot in the head. Witnesses, and again, talking about, you know, at the time, my friend George lived in the apartments that this happened right next to, and there's still a plaque there, a memoriam plaque for the officers. And he recalls that night, too, about hearing the shots and hearing people call for help. And as John Hyde gets on his motorcycle to flee, he's heard shouting, Mexican Mafia rules, and he takes off. So basically a pursuit happens. Police were able to find John Hyde, obviously, later. But in between that, Kate Presbyterian locked down. Mm-hmm. They basically closed. Once they got word that Officer King and Smith had been shot, they secured the hospital and they locked it down. A homicide commander arrives on the scene around 11:19 p.m. and they start investigating this as a homicide, obviously. Around 1:46, employees get an email saying that there's no longer a threat. And that's because Hyde has finally been detained. Police were able to track him down in the early morning hours. He tried to avoid them. He got into some sort of scuffle, but eventually he was apprehended.
This is after five people are dead.
Yep, five people are dead. So the interesting thing is, well, there's a lot of interesting things. So Ben Lopez, who's the first victim of John Hyde.
Yeah.
Who Ben probably interacted with that previous day when he tells his wife, I had this interaction with a guy asking me for oil for his motorcycle. I remember later on, John Hyde goes to that motorcycle shop looking to exchange oil mm-hmm. for motorcycle oil. So when Ben Lopez's widow is told about his murder, she obviously has a physical reaction. She starts to feel really ill. Her family's concerned about her health. She has no idea what's going on other than she's just been told that her husband has been murdered. So her family calls her family physician. They page him. He calls the family back. And she gets on the phone with her family physician and she's telling him, my husband is dead. He's been murdered. Who would do such a horrible thing? And the physician is like, I'm so sorry. That's horrible. The family physician turns out to be a cousin of John Hyde.
No way.
What are the freaking odds? Later in retrospect, when people were able to speak with the cousin, who, again, is a physician, he said that, you know, he and John were actually pretty close. He had given John a place to live for a period of time when he recognized that his schizophrenia was basically becoming more severe. You know, he basically had a casita that he let John live in for a period of time. And he, you know, he remembers telling John, you can live with me while you just focus on your mental health and you don't have to worry about anything. Don't worry about the plants. Don't worry about my pets. You just take care of yourself. And when the physician, the cousin goes out of town in a very small period of time, John somehow manages to expend 300,000 gallons of water watering the plants. He basically just left the taps, going. And that was like something that the cousin, the family physician, remembers, you know, that how ill John was, that he was told specifically, don't worry about the plants. But John then goes and leaves the water on, going through 300,000 gallons of water. And it's also so surreal that the cousin happens to be the treating physician of the widow of John's first victim.
Wow.
What are the odds?
I mean, Albuquerque is a small town in a lot of ways, I think, but that's still shocking information.
Another thing that the cousin, the physician, and John Hyde's brother did an interview with NBC some time ago, and they talk about, you know, their relationship with John and his schizophrenia. And the cousin physician talks about schizophrenia as being this kind of revolving door. He describes it as this revolving door where sometimes the door opens enough where light can come in. Can shine in and you feel better. And he said those moments with John basically got fewer and fewer. And Robert, his brother, talks about how smart John was when they were growing up and how it was so mystifying to them that he wouldn't choose to go to college even though he had been given all these scholarships. He decided not to go. And it's just like one of those things, again, where you think about what could have been, right?
Yeah.
So eventually John, you know, is captured on August 19th after he flees police. They were able to detain him. He is charged with these murders, but he never faced trial. And that's because he was deemed incompetent. A psychiatric review deemed that he wasn't able to stand trial due to his incompetence. And he was basically held at the Las Vegas Mental Health Hospital here in New Mexico. We have a town in New Mexico called Las Vegas. It's not the Nevada Las Vegas, obviously, but it's known for its mental health hospital. Mm-hmm. It's the only one in the state that I'm aware of that offers long-term care and treatment for the severely mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And so every 2 years, John typically comes up for review to see whether or not he's able to stand trial for his crimes. And every few years, he is still deemed to be unable to do that. His brother Robert believes that John will die in the Las Vegas Mental Health Hospital. He does visit his brother. He describes him as a very sad person who has kind of, you know, realized now that he's probably going to die there. And it's sad, obviously, on twofold. You have families affected, loved ones affected, who will never feel like their day in court has been given. It doesn't look like he's ever going to be able to stand trial for these crimes. And also John's family, who, from what I can tell, it sounds like they tried to do everything that they could for him, dealing with something like schizophrenia. I don't know anybody close to me, but I have met people who were schizophrenic, and it's incredibly challenging and scary. And it can manifest in different ways, like paranoia, delusions. And John checked all of those most serious aspects of schizophrenic. It just is – there's no positive resolution in this case, unfortunately. And the other thing that you think about, his access to weapons. People knew he had access to weapons. And legally, there's nothing on the books that says that people could intervene with that right? So you see this – the progress of trying to push forward red flag laws or things like that. Who knows if that could have helped the situation. And another unusual thing is that the gun that John Hyde used, it was an antique. It was a gun from 1918. People don't even see it. It had to be modified just to manage the caliber that he was seeking out. Previously, the days leading up to the homicides, he was seeking out ammunition, and the gun that he used was an antique gun. It wasn't known for its deadly impact alone as a standalone gun. Mm-hmm. It could knock you down, it was reported, but it wasn't known for being a deadly gun.
Right.
But it had to be modified for today's ammunition, and that's probably what
made it deadly.
Yeah, made it deadly. So that's the story of John Hyde in Albuquerque and his spree killing.
Well, this was a bummer episode for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think we're going to get any complaints about our laughing, because I don't think we laughed really at all through this entire episode. Thank you for listening, and stay safe, New Mexico.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to True Consequences. Follow me on Facebook and Instagram at True Consequences Pod, and on Twitter at True Cons Pod. True Consequences is listener supported. If you'd like to support this one-man show, please go to patreon.com/trueconsequences. Thanks for listening, and stay safe, New Mexico.